From our community room studio at Grand Center, welcome to you at home and to you and our studio audience for our special post-election St. Louis on the Air broadcast. It is, as they say, all over but the shouting as election 2012 is over. The winners are cheering, the losers are not, and the dust is beginning to settle. Or is it? We'll be taking a look at sometimes surprising election results on today's program. I'm Don Marsh. With me at our Grand Center studios, Joe Manis, political reporter for the St. Louis Beacon, Dave Robertson, political scientist at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, St. Louis Public Radio political reporter Chris McDaniel, and Maria Altman, St. Louis Public Radio News. She covered the McCaskill campaign celebration last night. Thank you all so much for being with us today. Nice to have you. I'm going to ask each one of you, and I'll start with you, Dave Robertson, and work our way right down the table there. Give me your headline from what happened yesterday, in any context, national, local, whatever.
Democrats come back from what seemed to be a deep hole.
Joe?
Now there is certainty, but not what the Republicans wanted.
Yeah. All right. Chris?
Missourians split tickets.
All right, and Maria.
McCaskill won big and fairly early.
Tell us a little bit about that. You were there, and she did win early. We in studio upstairs were saying very early that she pretty much had it in the bag. When did they sense that that was the case?
Well, it was interesting because, I, of course, had my computer there, and I was watching Twitter, and NBC and CBS and PBS had called the race, but the people in the room at the Chase didn't know it yet. And so I would hear, as I walked through the crowd, a few people here and there saying, she has it, she's won. But a lot of people didn't know until about 15 minutes later when CNN announced the race. And then, of course, they went wild. But I heard from many people that they were surprised that she won as early as she did.
I drove past the Chase coming down here last night. It looked like a national political convention. There were satellite trucks all over the place. What interest in this race?
Oh, it was unbelievable. And I counted, I think, 12 or 13 cameras up on the riser, which I was behind. It was incredible to see all the national press. And, of course, we had NPR's David Wellna was covering it. But there was a big spotlight on Missouri. And, the national GOP had made Claire McCaskill a real target. And with it tightening as much as it did, and of course, in the end, the fact that she was able to win and Democrats ultimately kept the U.S. Senate.
I want to get the impressions of our other panelists, but let's play a clip from her speech last night in which she was claiming victory. And she right away went to the fact that they said it couldn't be done.
18 months ago, there was a lot of the political chattering classes that were spouting a lot of information about the Senate race in Missouri. And they all said, it's over. It's done. It's too red. It's just too red. There is no way that Claire McCaskill can survive. Well, you know what happened? You proved them wrong.
Senator.
With a stubborn determination, tenacity, and a refusal to give up, we showed the country what Missouri is made of.
Senator Claire McCaskill, of course. Joe Manis, I'm going to turn to you next. You've been covering the political scene in this neck
for
of the woods
time.
For a long, long time. Let's not talk about exactly how long, but it's been a long time. And you're all over this campaign. Your impressions with regard to what happened last night and how it happened?
Well, when I saw the early returns, and this is less than 10%, what, 2 or 3 percentage points, and it was coming from rural Missouri, and at first it was tied, and then she was running ahead. So by the time there was just 5%, I was talking in the office, and I said, she's going to do it, because Missouri is so polarized. I mean, it always has been this way for the last 30, 40 years, where a Republican has to win big, like 55% or above in rural Missouri to counter similar percent, well, actually larger percentages in the urban areas, but there's fewer people in the urban areas. And then the suburbs usually make or break whoever wins. So in this case, usually early returns, you would have the Republican winning big, and then you're just waiting to see when the urban comes in, what happens. Well, with her leading, you know, with 51%, 52% early on, it's like it's over. And in fact, one of the Aiken people called me this morning and said to me that when they saw that they were losing Greene County, which is Springfield, they knew it was over. But they didn't want to say anything until they were sure what was going on in St. Charles County. She won St. Charles County and Greene County. These are the two most Republican counties in the state. Generally speaking, a Republican needs to win them big and does. And the fact that she did that cannot be ignored. I mean, the scope of her victory actually surprised many of us, because a lot of us, including myself, have been saying, well, it'll be close. No, it wasn't. And I also believe the people who voted in St. Charles and Greene County, it wasn't the Republican guys who voted for her. This was a huge, I think, that because you won't know till you do the gender breakdown, but even then they'll never know. It was basically Republican women who crossed. I was looking at the figures. There was 410,000 people who voted for Mitt Romney who did not vote for Todd Aiken. That's 410,000 people. And I bet my paycheck that the vast majority of those 410 were women.
So, Dave Robertson, what shall we say, that Claire McCaskill won it or that Todd Aiken lost it?
Both are true. Claire McCaskill ran a good campaign, took advantage of the opportunities she had at every turn. She raised a whole lot of money and spent four times as much as Todd Aiken did. But Todd Aiken's comments, his frankness on the issue of abortion and rape, and his comment about legitimate rape, really caused the polls to cross. You could see McCaskill rise right after August 19th when he did the interview with Charles Jayco, and you could see her, you could see him begin to slip. One of the remarkable things yesterday is that Jonathan Dine got over 6% of the vote, a Libertarian candidate. That's amazing to me. And you also, I want to see the fall off in votes between the other races and this race. Former Senator Danforth was asked about whether or not he voted for Aiken. He said, I vote the straight Republican ticket, but I might have missed that particular race. So you know, this was a big win for McCaskill and a big, big loss for Aiken.
Yeah. Okay, Chris, last but certainly not least, your impressions.
Well, Joe and I had predicted that Jonathan Dine would have a huge impact on this race, and he really did do phenomenally for a third-party candidate. He got over 6%. But really, he wasn't the make-or-break thing for Congressman Aiken, because even if Todd Aiken had gotten all of that 6.1%, it still wouldn't have been enough for him to win. And typically, Libertarian candidates do siphon off conservative votes from other conservatives.
So, there we are. Claire McCaskill goes back to the Senate. She goes back in a very strong position, I would think,
yes,
doesn't she, Joe?
Yes, extremely. I think there has been talk for a while. I was thinking about this driving home, that with this victory, because she had not been predicted, she won big, and she built this herself. I mean, she had to build this whole grassroots operation herself, because there was no presidential contest in the state. Generally speaking, candidates running statewide, if there's a big presidential contest in the state, they sort of merge and really rely on that. Of course, that's what helped seal her defeat 2004 for governor when Kerry left. But in this case, she did it herself because there wasn't that much cooperation between her and the governor on some of this. And so I think that she will be a power in Washington, but also within the Missouri Democratic Party. I think this is going, you may see a little bit of a power struggle a little bit between her and the governor, because while he won big as well, his had been expected. Hers was not. And she'll be a force to be reckoned with in Washington. And I wouldn't be surprised if she's on some shortlist 2016, not necessarily for president, but any Democratic presidential candidate needs to be looking to the Midwest for somebody for a running mate. And there's been a lot of speculation about Nixon being on that list, and he probably is. But now, as of what happened last night, I would say that Claire McCaskill's on that list, too.
They almost got the same number of votes.
Yeah, 500.
Night.
The governor got 500 more votes, which I'm sure his allies will make sure she knows.
You know, in terms of McCaskill doing this all by herself, I mean, this really happened exactly the way she wanted it to happen. She wanted to run against Congressman Aiken. She released ads, you know, saying that he was a conservative candidate in the primary, which that's a rallying cry for people who are going to go to the polls in the primary. She was hoping that he would have some statement like this, which some sort of outlandish statement that would make him not eligible to win this race. And it really happened exactly the way she wanted it to.
Maria, we're talking about how strong Claire McCaskill will likely be when she goes back to Washington. Did you get any sense in talking to people last night about the relationship with the White House? She's going to have to deal with those folks, and she really kept her distance during this campaign.
Well, you know, the people at the Chase were very much, I was interested in how so many of the people I talked to said that this was the first campaign that they had worked for. And I thought that was said something. It was this election, and they felt it was so important to get Claire McCaskill back to Washington. But they were also saying that they were very much supporters of the president. So I think that there was an understanding of sort of the political situation of why Senator McCaskill distanced herself from the president. I don't think that they saw that as any sort of real distance,
Joe?
If you will.
Well, she did. I saw her yesterday morning. I was with her yesterday morning when she voted, and we talked about this for a while because I've talked to her about this before. She has played this. She's distanced herself for a little bit, but just sort of. I mean, she has said all along she would like to have seen Obama or somebody like Biden come in the state and help her raise money and also to galvanize the base. There was some concern that there may not be a strong turnout in the city of St. Louis, for example, that they would get the percentage but not the numbers, because it's not just getting 70% of the city vote. You need to have a big city vote. And with Congressman Clay not facing any real challenge, there was concern about whether or not there would be that. But so she wasn't, and yesterday morning when someone asked her, she said, of course I want the president to win, but that's not what I'm focusing on. But I think when she goes to Washington, though, while I think she and the president are friends, especially from 2008, because she was one of the first who came out for him, she's not going to owe them anything. The White House really didn't do anything for her. I think they will respect her, but she owes them nothing.
I've got to take a break. Dave, you've been nodding your head throughout Joe's statement there. Hold that thought, if you would. I have to take a break now, reminding our audience that they're listening to our political roundtable discussion, a postmortem following yesterday's Election Day results. We'll be back to continue that conversation in just a moment. With me in our community room studio at Grand Center, Dave Robertson of the University of Missouri St. Louis, Joe Manis of the St. Louis Beacon, Chris McDaniel, St. Louis Public Radio political reporter, and Maria Altman, St. Louis Public Radio news reporter. Back to continue our conversation and take questions from our studio audience in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our discussion following yesterday's election with our political roundtable panelists. We've been talking about the biggest news, I think, out of Missouri, certainly, and in many cases, perhaps across the nation, too, the win by Claire McCaskill here yesterday. Dave, you were nodding in the affirmative that Joe was talking. What do you want to add to that?
Mostly I was agreeing, but I'd make two additional points. I'm going to bet, though I haven't seen the numbers, that almost all the senators who won, the Democratic senators, ran ahead of Obama in their states. There may be exceptions in New England, but they too will feel a lot of independence of Obama. But they also, in many cases, really emphasize a kind of moderate independence, kind of a centrist perspective in most cases. So it might be that the moderates we've been missing in the U.S. Congress, maybe there's a little bit more of a moderate centrist spirit in the next Congress that will be dealing with all these tough issues.
I have a question here that kind of falls in line with what you've just said in a different aspect, however. This is from David, who writes, Claire and Jane Nixon had their races won before the city of St. Louis and the county returns came in. Is this a new political paradigm for Missouri Democrats? Thoughts on that, any of you? Joe?
I still think it had a lot to do with these rural women. I really do, because now Nixon's always done well in rural Missouri. But I think this sends a signal. I was wondering about this because the state house, actually, the Republicans may have gained a seat or two. We were still looking at it last night. So actually the state house may be slightly more Republican. They may actually have a veto-proof majority now in the state house. In the Senate, the Democrats, because of redistricting and winning one, the Democrats, there are 10 Democrats in the Senate as of this instead of 8. So they're up a bit. But all of those legislators who've been extremely partisan on both sides, but particularly because the Republicans were in control and they've been blocking the governor on a number of things, I think they're going to have to look at this because Peter Kinder is the only Republican statewide left standing. And I think they're going to have to think many of these legislators want to run statewide. And whereas on a micro level, Romney's victories may have helped him, on the macro level in Missouri, it didn't. It was like the presidential contest was off in its own little universe.
We should point out one of the more vocal legislators, Senator Lemke, will not be returning to Jefferson City.
That's right. Yeah. He lost. That was the Republican Senate loss last night, the notable one. And I think some legislators, I'm going to be really interested because I had talked to some Republican leaders in the legislature a couple weeks ago about what their thoughts were about their chances statewide and this and that and these contests and why they had such big majorities in the General Assembly, but the Democrats are controlling most of the state house offices. And they were saying, well, you know, this will change. We'll capture a couple on November 6th and then we can build on that, this and that. Well, now they're back. And the only one left is Peter Kinder, who many of them don't like. I mean, so that it's going to be a very fascinating next session. I really think so.
Let me throw this one to Chris, because we have a question from Sue. How did Peter Kinder pull this off, given his baggage and other Democratic executive wins?
Well, that's a good question.
That's why we gave it to you.
Well, we were speculating in the newsroom it might have just been simple name recognition.
Yeah.
But Susan Monty, she's not an unknown. No. You know, she's a higher up in the Democratic Party. It's difficult to say. Kinder did not really campaign in St. Louis, hardly at all. Monty came for a few union rallies and a few women's events, but Kinder pretty much avoided St. Louis and kind of avoided journalists, too.
Yes.
He was certainly not too eager to have interviews. But it apparently didn't hurt him.
Apparently not. Well, it was reelected for the third term. The name recognition certainly had to come into play there somehow. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. Although I think it's going to kill his talk about term limits, which he used to be an advocate of.
Right.
That doesn't bother a lot of politicians if they flip-flop on certain issues. I'm going in another direction here with this question from Clint. We haven't talked about the propositions and many other things we haven't talked about yet, but what will happen to health care exchanges in Missouri now that President Obama is reelected and Missouri rejected setting up the exchanges without a vote of the people or the legislature?
I think it's pretty clear the federal government will set it up.
Right.
It's going to happen anyway.
Yeah, that's the irony of this. People who voted for that might also be very supportive of federalism and state discretion and state control, but they just voted to kick the responsibility for an important administrative set of actions back to the federal government. So
I'm so glad you didn't say kick the can down the road.
No.
You know, that's one of those things I'm really, really, really tired of hearing. let's talk about Governor Nixon's reelection. he really had to walk a very fine line, did he not? And I'll throw this out to anyone who cares to answer it. In the way he had to run this campaign, we've got a red state, he's a Democrat, and he's got a very conservative constituency out there. Talk about his campaign. Who would like to discuss the way he pulled this off? Chris?
Well, the way he ran his campaign was, it was less of a campaign and more of him just doing gubernatorial events. He would show up and hand out an award to a farmer or cut a ribbon at a new business. Few of his events were typical campaign events. He had a couple of high-profile union rallies that he was at, but other than that, he was mostly doing the I'm just doing my job kind of thing. And apparently it worked. I was at the Spence campaign watch party last night, or the election night watch party last night, and you know, in previous talks with Spence, he's been saying the entire time that this race is a referendum on jobs and the economy. And I asked him, you know, since you lost and it was overwhelming, does that mean that Missourians are okay with the economy and they are content with the way it's moving? Because we are doing better than most states. Our unemployment rate is at 6.9, which is about, you know, a full point lower than it is nationally. He pushed away on that. He said that it was mostly due to people splitting their tickets, but he wouldn't explain why that happened. Spence was a little bit bitter last night. He was talking about the Nixon campaign slinging arrows at him, and he said it's taken a toll on his family.
Yeah, $6 million worth of toll.
$6.6 million. He put in another $600,000 really? On just a few days before.
Wow. Right.
It's a tough business, and when it's your first campaign, you learn how tough a business it is.
Well, and to be fair, from the get-go, Spence used some pretty volatile words in some of his early events. And especially,
the forum, too.
And at the forum in Columbia in September, which was their only joint event, where he used the word corruption and corrupt and stuff like that, pointing to the governor while they're standing there. And many of us reporters who were there were seeing, okay, Nixon's a tall guy. He's a big guy, mm-hmm. former basketball player, and he's kind of looming over Spence. And while the Nixon people deny this, most of the reporters, we're all sitting there, we're watching him get redder, and we're like, it's like a volcano. You're just waiting for, you know, okay. Well, nothing happened. He kept himself in control. But soon after that, those ads came out that referred to Spence as a banker and the stuff with the vacation home, and it's like, whap, whap, whap. And I was surprised that Spence, who's a very savvy guy and who was actually easier to work with as far as a reporter, that they were not expecting that after he was using some of this volatile language against the governor, to not expect that he was going to turn around and, you know, let him have it back.
I actually asked Spence what role he thought the banker ads played in the race, and he said this: he won and I didn't, so if he can sleep at night, I guess that's what he has to do.
All right. In terms of, Joe, you alluded to this, and again, anyone who wants to respond, in terms of the language used during this campaign, I was somewhat distressed as a citizen listening to some of the language that folks were using. The word liar kept popping up, and I've talked to a couple of them about this. That's a very strong word to use. There are other ways to say that a person is not telling the truth without using that particular word. Any of you have any feelings about that, about the way language is evolving in our political campaigns, and particularly how it's played here?
Well, I don't know if Missouri was any different than some of the other states. And I'm no expert like Dave Robertson, but I have been studying a lot the last couple of years, a lot of the founders and the early stuff. And stuff was, I mean, they used harsher words than liar, you know, a couple hundred years ago. And I think that while politics has definitely gotten coarser, in some ways we're going back to the way it was in the 1800s. We basically had a period of about 60, 70 years where people were a bit more polite, and they're kind of shedding that now. I'm not advocating that. I'm just looking at what you're seeing. And I think in some ways that when one party starts it, I think there's been a attempt a few years ago by the other party, whichever one, to try to tamp things down a bit. But that really didn't work. And people who lobbed those attacks often won. So the other side was like, well, if they're doing that, I've got to do that too. And I think that we're going to be seeing more of that. And I do want to mention one quick thing on the exchanges, because that kind of fits in. Mm-hmm. I think the General Assembly, which got this thing on the ballot that the voters approved, the Republicans on the General Assembly, many of whom are conservative, are going to have to think about this, whether they want to go ahead, and now that Obama's reelected, and pass some sort of health insurance exchange setup so that Missouri can control what's in it, mm-hmm. or, like Maria said, all of a sudden it becomes federal, and it may end up being a more liberal exchange than what the General Assembly would like. So I'll be curious to see what happens in the next 60 days to see if they moderate some of their rhetoric. That's how I'm excusing.
Dave, did you want
to? We've seen this story play out before in other programs, Medicaid, Clean Air Act implementation, where the federal government has this stick that it will take over programs and run them at the states now.
Well, you know, this, we're hopping around a little bit because there's so much to discuss, but this brings me to a question I wanted to ask at some point. I'll ask it now. What has changed? What has changed in Missouri, and what has changed in Washington? I mean, the setup is pretty much the same, certainly in Washington, and to a very large degree here in Missouri, as was the case before, however many billions of dollars were spent. What's changed?
Well, there's 17 very wealthy men across the country who are probably not very happy. The only race that they spent those arguably billions of dollars on to attack, I was looking at something this morning before I came in, was a Texas Senate race that would have ended up going Republican anyway. I think there may have been some pushback in the public against that, but I was actually amazed at all these attack ads, all the stuff that went on, and all these accusations, all the stuff that you were talking about. And in the end, the Democrats made some gains in the U.S. Senate, and some people like Claire McCaskill survived, and Barack Obama was reelected. And frankly, if none of that money had been spent, it probably would have been similar.
But we're not looking at a kumbaya moment in Washington
all of a sudden.
No, or here.
Not at all. Karl Rove kind of had a meltdown on Fox last night.
Yeah. So what's changed? I mean, we're still going to have this polarization for sure.
But I think the Democrats may be emboldened now. And that could be bad because whatever side's emboldened often does stuff that they shouldn't be doing or goes too far. But I think they're going to feel like, hey, you know, we defeated all this stuff. We stood up and managed to withstand all this stuff and won. And I think you could see a feistier. Actually, it could be nastier in the in Washington, and possibly in the General Assembly in the short term because of that. I think.
Well, the reporters will love that, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But the country, not so much. Dave.
Democrats. The story may be on the Democratic side, but it's going to be fascinating to see what happens on the Republican side. In 2010, you could argue, I would, that the Tea Party influence cost Republicans the Senate. This year, cost the Republicans at least two seats,
yes,
maybe more. And the result is, you know, Republicans have to face this problem of whether they're going to compete to win a majority of votes or whether they can continue to stroke their base with all kinds of very strong language and position taking that is not playing into the direction the demographics of the country are taking.
Any other thoughts? If not, I'll just move along. I have a tweet here from Dick Fleming, whom we all know as the former head of the RCGA. It fits in with what we're talking about here. As noted, with mega issues to be resolved, it's now time for bipartisan governing in the Danforth-Eagleton tradition. The President of the United States could take a big step with a Nixon goes to China with national business leaders. See that happening?
Possibly. I could see that, but I think that some of the other stuff... on both sides.
Let me just repeat, it is from Dick Fleming, so I think we know where he's coming from on that.
Yeah. I'll tell you, Obama was criticized for not laying out his plans for a second term, but right now he has pretty much a blank check for defining the direction he's going to go in and for being a little opportunistic in finding ways to advance the agenda and at the same time address these problems like slower economic growth than people would like, and the budget deficit in particular, in ways that are a little more creative than you might expect, because he didn't take that clear, strong position and run on it. It's clear, though, that he will fight for a tax increase for higher-income people.
I wonder, though, if the House of Representatives will just dig their heels in, as they have done so often in the last 4 years, if, you know, that fiscal cliff, could it still happen?
Well, Mitch McConnell had a comment yesterday which indicated, even though he didn't get his wish for a one-term presidency, that he's digging in for the next 4 years as well. So that's the Senate side, of course, where he has a little less clout than the House Republicans have.
We'll see a lot of shadow boxing, too. Don't take everything you hear from people seriously. They're taking positions.
Yeah. As time is moving along, let me get this question in from Dana. What is your opinion on why the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Channel 4, and the Kansas City Star poll a week before the election were so wrong by predicting a close contest in the Missouri Senate race? Any thoughts on that,
well,
Joe?
Mason Dixon, and I hate to knock a particular polling firm, because it's not like I'm a pollster. I just have dealt with them. They also did some polls like in Florida, and they had Romney up, this is like a day or two before the election, up by 5 or 6 points. And it looks like Obama will likely pull out Florida, even with all the battles over people getting to vote. I think it's not a bad idea because of economy for some of the major news outlets to get together on a poll if that's the only way they can get one. And the timing was good. They didn't have it closer than 10 days. I think that's irresponsible to have it too close. But I think that there probably will be some discussions. This was the first year that they'd used in Mason-Dixon, and they may be looking to other – this is in the weeds, but I think they'll probably be looking at other polling firms next time.
Dave. If I can build on that from the other side, SurveyUSA did a poll that looks pretty darn good today. It had Aiken quite far behind. It had Nixon up considerably, not as much as McCaskill, and it had Obama losing, and those things happen. So SurveyUSA, which has, despite questions about its methodology, it does robocalls for landlines, it turns out pretty good. And it looks like pollsters did a reasonable job, despite the fact that a third of people in the United States now use cell phones as their main phone and don't have a landline. That looks pretty good. People like Nate Silver came out great. He looks great today. Boy, he's going to be hard to live with for a while. He projected 303 electoral votes, which is what we have now, probably going to add Florida. The people who did badly were partisan pollsters. Rasmussen didn't do so well. Gallup didn't do so well. It's not seen as having a tilt toward one party or the other, but Gallup didn't look so good. And then political analysts who really are quite partisan, like Michael Barone has become a pollster like that, or rather an analyst like that. Dick Morris, of course, takes the award for worst predictor in the United States today. So science wins. Science won this. Facts won this. Reality is reality. You can't make it what you don't, something you want it to be.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny when I was, and I never would have said I'd say this, they might want to be looking at McCaskill's pollster. I mean, she was claiming she was up by 13 or 14 percentage points, and we were all like, right. Well, she carried by 15, so her pollster.
Got to take another break, but if any folks at the other end of the table want to comment, let's take that break now. This is our political roundtable discussion. We're talking about the results of yesterday's election with Dave Robertson from the University of Missouri, St. Louis, Joe Manis from St. Louis Beacon, Chris McDaniel from St. Louis Public Radio, and Maria Altman. Back in just a second, we'll take more questions from our studio audience here and continue the conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our political roundtable discussion following yesterday's election. A lot of ground to cover yet and not a whole lot of time, so I'm going to try to move it along. We have a follow-up question for Joe here. from one of our reporters upstairs, by the way, Joe. Okay. Joe, the split ticket in Missouri with the presidential race as in its own universe. How would the panel speculate about the role of race in Missouri in the Missouri election results?
Well, I'm not going to ignore. I mean, you know, there is a racial history in Missouri, but I'm not sure if that played as big a role in this as some of the other stuff. But there were. Claire McCaskill got votes from 270,000 people who didn't vote for the president, and who so you got 270,000 people who arguably voted for Mitt Romney and then switched to her. As I said, there was 410,000 people who voted for Romney and didn't vote for Aiken, but there was also a fall off because we don't have straight ticket voting because the Republicans got rid of it. And in 2006, where you could punch one button at the top and it would automatically vote for every person of that party all the way down. They thought that helped Democrats more than them. But this election, 90,000 people, by the time they got to the attorney general race, had quit voting. So the attorney general race and state treasurer and secretary of state got about 90,000, or actually about 100,000 in the case of Secretary of State, fewer votes than those at the top. So you had that many people who at some point they did president, they did Senate, they did governor, and then they were like, I'm out of here.
Race matters in Missouri, there's no doubt about that. The thing that struck me about the polls, you know, and I'm just sort of thinking through this now in between classes, is that it looks like Obama pulled about as many Democrats, percentage of the Democrats in the exit polls, as did Romney among Republicans. That's a little different than it was in 2008. Joe and I have talked a little bit about a couple of the polls we've looked at that had relatively low percentages of Democrats relative to Republicans, and it is quite possible that race is played out indirectly by realigning some of the people away from the Democrats toward the Republicans or toward independents, so that we have a smaller number of self-identified Democrats, but they are more committed to Democratic candidates all up and down the line than the electorate was in 2008. Anyway, that's what I'm trying to think through.
Well, and one of the things that did strike me this election season, and Democrats may disagree with me on this, but I thought there was far fewer major public events in urban areas or in African-American areas. There was virtually none, even by the Democrats. And I wondered about that, if that was going to affect African-American turnout when these people aren't showing up in their neighborhoods to hold events. But they came out, I mean, African-Americans in this state came out for, arguably for Obama, and then they did vote for these other candidates, because if McCaskill, it turns out McCaskill and Nixon didn't necessarily need that huge urban margin, but it sure helped some of these others. I mean, because the Secretary of State, Jason Kander, only won by 30-some thousand votes, and he was trailing through most of the night until the urban votes came in. So in some areas, I think the urban votes and the down-ballot races made the difference. So I think there is a little bit of a racial factor, and I think also the fact that there was no statewide candidates, major statewide candidates, who were minority. It was virtually all white and 90% of them guys, except for McCaskill and Monty.
So. The times are changing. There was a piece on NPR this morning indicating that the percentage of white electorate in this country has gone down from 74% to 72%. And that decline is certainly expected to continue with a rise in Hispanic population, for instance.
Right. So times the Hispanics voted, they were about 10% of the electorate for the first time in double digits in percentages. But again, Missouri is turning redder because it's not keeping up with those demographics across the country. We don't have a very big Latino population.
Okay. Well, it seemed like Senator McCaskill was planning on doing more get-out-the-vote events in African-American communities up until the point when her mother became ill and passed away. So I think that interfered a little bit with those plans.
Want to take another direction here. Proposition B, we have a couple of questions with regard to that. That's the cigarette tax. Timothy writes, I was surprised Proposition B wasn't passed. Could your guests explain why the majority of voters rejected it? And also, the failure of the tax, what does it really mean for higher education's future funding? Any thoughts, Maria?
I think two things on the cigarette tax. One, the effort by the opponents. If anyone got gas, they may have noticed the signs that said more than 700% tax increase, and it didn't say on what. So I think that for many voters, they may have decided, okay, I'm going to vote against that, and they may not have connected it with cigarettes. And, you know, it's been close traditionally. The last two elections, it was really close on the cigarette tax, and I think that supporters sort of threw in the education component to really get more people behind it, and that didn't seem to have worked. And, you know, I would also say that the ballot measure itself was not written very clearly. I, you know, reading the ballot summary, it was sort of like, huh?
You're not the first person to complain about ballot summaries, that's for sure.
No, and not the last either. Yeah,
no doubt. Any other thoughts from other panelists with regard to Proposition B? What about local control? We should mention that. It passed. Surprise?
I don't think so. I don't think it was a surprise, with especially if you're a voter in Neosho and you're asked, should St. Louis have control of its own police department, it seems pretty clear. Well, why not? Sure. And I think that supporters knew if they could get it on the ballot, it was likely going to pass. And it had big, big money behind it in investor Rex Singfield. So it was not a surprise to me, at least.
Well, and it was one of his few, Singfield's one of his few successes of the night, but which is a separate thing. But I think I think the police association and some of the groups that were either cool to this and previously had been against it, had kind of been neutral for this election. I think you're going to be seeing some tense negotiations the next few months between them and City Hall. But, yeah, I mean, this was something that was eventually going to come around. I mean, the state has controlled the St. Louis Police Department for 150 years. And sooner or later, outstate voters were, I think, going to think, why are we doing that? I mean, especially with term limits now in the legislature, used to have veteran legislators from the city of St. Louis especially who enjoyed having a lot of influence on the police department. I mean, before term limits, if a policeman wanted a promotion, they often went to the legislator, not to aldermen or other urban Democrats. Well, now with term limits, that's kind of cut that. And most of the legislators in Jefferson City, they're like, why are we dealing with this? But I think they're also, this may also prompt, Kansas City remains under state control. And so you wonder how long that will happen before forces there say, well, if St. Louis is now control their police department, why don't we? So I could see in a few years a similar effort in Kansas City, maybe.
I thought for 150 years, Missouri may have moved a little recklessly given the history of the state of Missouri. So.
Recklessly, if not very fast, needless to say. So Jeff Rainford had the great line about, I don't think we have to worry about Confederate troops coming into the city of St. Louis and taking over. let's take one moment to talk about the nonpartisan court plan. This is a big issue. Supporters lost big time. Any thoughts about that and where that leaves us? Maria?
I think that we're definitely going to see this issue come up again. Supporters had backed away from it. They had raised a lot less money than opponents, and they didn't like the ballot language. They'd taken it to court. They didn't win there, and then, so they decided we're not going to be campaigning for this. So the big numbers against it, I think, are in part because of that. But this is an issue I think we're going to see again. And it's of national interest. You have some national groups that really want to see the way judges are chosen in Missouri changed, because we have sort of the nonpartisan court plan that many other states have.
More than 30 states.
Right, Right. Yeah. So if they can change it here, they can change it likely in other states.
Jim Lemke, when he was on one of our programs here just a couple of days ago, predicted that the legislature would pass legislation calling for a popular vote for our appellate court judges, which is what they do in Illinois, and people who follow that sort of thing realize what sort of problems that has created for them. Any thoughts about the potential for that kind of legislation here, Joe?
I think because of what happened on the statewide level, I'll be surprised. I could be wrong. I'm often wrong. But I think that the House and the Senate in Missouri, while they remain strongly in Republican hands, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of those legislators are going to be looking at for running for greater office or statewide office, and they're going to be looking at these totals. And I think there's going to be some people wondering if maybe they shouldn't be pushing that, but maybe pushing some other things. And because one of the things we didn't mention on the national level, which is related to this, Obama's reelection means that probably at least two, maybe three Supreme Court justices may be replaced and over the next few years, and it's going to be a Democrat replacing him. And that could have an effect among this court movement. I think they're going to be so busy trying to fend off some of the things that they're seeing elsewhere that perhaps Missouri's court plan may have gotten a reprieve. I could be wrong, but I think they're going to be focused on so many other judicial things that they may back off here.
Dave, I was surprised not more was made of this, the president's ability to name Supreme Court justices, because if there's anything that gives a presidency its legacy, that's it.
That's absolutely true, and ask George Bush about that. His legacy on the court is going to be there for many, many years to come. But the Supreme Court just doesn't emerge as a big issue in these elections when foreign policy overshadows it, as it did in 2004, or the economy overshadows it. Social issues affect seem to mobilize more people than the Supreme Court, which is an indirect and uncertain factor in the kinds of policies people really aim to achieve.
Lots of things left unsaid. Our time is getting away. I want to go back down to Maria and to Chris to talk about two other races we haven't mentioned, the Attorney General's race and the Treasurer's race. Any comment that either of you would care to make with regard to that, Chris?
Well, it's funny that you bring them both up, because I would say in 2016 you're going to see a contentious primary between Clint Zweifel and Chris Koster. Those both of them came out winning pretty handily in their races, and I would say that that sets them up pretty nicely to run against each other in 2016 for governor.
Looking ahead, Maria?
I think Chris had it on the nose, so okay. I'll leave it at that.
Less than a minute left. I'll give Dave and Joe, it has to be quick, if you have anything you want to add on this. Quicker than that.
I think
a lot
of people are hoping that moderation makes a little bit of a comeback here. Well, that greatly remains to be seen.
Well, I think that and I'm not advocating this. I'm just saying based on the totals, I think the photo ID fight in Missouri is going to be non-existent for a few years because that had been Shane Scholar's marquee issue in a Secretary of State contest, and he lost. And with the governor, Jay Nixon, I think they'll be blocking that. Also, they'll be blocking any right-to-work effort, which I think will also die because of what I mentioned earlier. So elections have consequences, and this one definitely did.
And the next campaign probably starts tomorrow, right? That was Joe Manis of the St. Louis Beacon. Joe, thanks for being with us. Dave Robertson, thank you. My two colleagues from St. Louis Public Radio, Chris McDaniel and Maria Altman, thank you so much for being with us for this political roundtable discussion. Okay, Chris McNabb, I should point out, by the way, that he works for us and also Beyond November, so you can read his material there. And speaking of that, a reminder that BeyondNovember.org is a collaboration of St. Louis Public Radio, the St. Louis Beacon, and the Nine Network of Public Media. It does not end with the election. It's important to cover the horse race, as almost everyone does, but it's even more vital to keep track of the candidates after they take office. We want to invite you to follow our coverage now and in the days to come by signing up for a free daily email update that will arrive each morning with the headlines from beyondnovember.org. Go to beyondnovember.org to subscribe, beyondnovember.org/subscribe. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Carolyn Stessinger about her book profiling the oldest living Holocaust survivor. Ms. Stessinger will also appear tonight at 7:30 at the JCC in Creve Coeur as part of the Jewish Book Festival. A special edition of St. Louis on the Air, produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, engineered by Greg Muttoneau, Aaron Dorr, with assistance from Ariana Tobin. Executive producers Robert Peterson. Special thanks to Terrence Dupuy, Phil Donato, and Jennifer Porter. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.